Over 50 years ago, I discovered as a small boy the joy or the amazement of science fiction. I can remember I was walking down the or through the local library in Macomb, Illinois, a small town west central Illinois, and in a farming community. And we had a Carnegie Library. How many of you know what Carnegie Libraries are? We have them here in Texas. Yeah, the Carnegie Foundation, way back, I guess, in the 20s, decided that they needed to put libraries throughout the country. And they built, I think, several thousand libraries. And the one I've seen here in Texas is in Murchison, Texas. Cindy and I were driving through Murchison once, and we drove by, and I said, I think that's a Carnegie Library, because they have a very distinct kind of Greco architecture. But we had a Carnegie Library in Macomb. And I was walking through the aisles, and I saw a sign that said science fiction. And I thought, well, science fiction. And so I went in, and I picked up a couple books. And over the next weeks and months, I was transported from that little town in rural Illinois to faraway galaxies. Men like Isaac Asimov and Gene Roddenberry expanded my view of the universe. There were domed cities on Venus, flying cars, robots that would do my bidding, personalized jetpacks that would take me around wherever I wanted to go. And I really began to love science fiction. But even as a child, I understood it was science fiction. This was not something that was to be taken literally. This was a fictionalized, a pretend version. It was Cinderella with robots, you know? And that's okay. I knew what that meant. I knew what fiction meant. And for purposes of escapism, I saw nothing wrong with science fiction, and I see nothing wrong with it now. I'm not sure you need a whole television channel devoted to science fiction. I've not ever dressed up in an outfit and gone to a convention for science fiction, but that's okay. I don't have any problem with people who watch it or people who go to those conventions. It's okay. Is it any stranger than going to a pinball convention? I don't think so, Ray. If I'm not going to criticize Ray Bourgeois for the pinball convention, I'm not going to criticize somebody for dressing up like an Ewok and going off to another convention. It's okay. Or wearing this suit. This is stranger than fiction. But, you know, science fiction was never intended to be taken literally. That's why they call it science fiction. It was never meant to be accepted as a science. Oh, yeah, people step back and say, you know, especially if you talk to people who really love science fiction, well, how many things were being written back, you know, 60 years ago that have now taken place? Well, yeah, to a very limited extent. I mean, robotics are more developed. There's more artificial intelligence research. But 99.9% of science fiction that was written back 60 years ago still hasn't taken place. I mean, it doesn't bother me that there aren't domed cities on Venus. I can live without those. It doesn't bother me that we do not have intergalactic travel available to us. Doesn't affect me. I don't even mind not having a flying car. Couldn't handle it. Although I've always wondered how we could put a man on the moon and not perfect individual backpacks, jetpacks. How can you put a man on the moon but not perfect a jetpack that can take you to work? I don't understand that. But I suppose. But while science fiction was never meant to be taken literally, there is one cult, one religion that has elevated it to the point of just that, a religion, a belief system. And we're going to look at that cult for the next 2 weeks. It's the cult of Scientology, a cult that is the result of the troubled imagination of a science fiction writer. Unashamedly, the result of a science fiction writer. I would be embarrassed to say I worshipped in a church whose teachings were based on those of a science fiction writer. If you're in Scientology, you take great pride of it, in it. So this week, I want us to look at just a couple things about Scientology. Next week, we're going to look at the theology of Scientology, because it does have a theology. This week, I just want to look at the character of Scientology. Exactly what is it? Because Scientology is constantly attempting to reinvent itself. Scientology is a moving target. So I want to look today at what is Scientology? What does it consist of? Secondly, I want to look at the guiding principles of Scientology. What are the guiding principles? Where did it come from? You know, the guiding principles of Christianity, I mean, if we want to look at it in the broadest sense, the guiding principle of the Bible is found where? Genesis 1:1. That's the guiding principle for the entire Bible. If you understand and embrace Genesis 1:1, the rest of the Bible unfolds rather seamlessly. If you reject Genesis 1:1, you're going to have problems with every other verse, including Genesis 1:2. If we get more specific, we can look and say, well, the guiding principle of Christianity is found in the Ten Commandments, in the first commandment. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your might. That's the guiding principle. If we want to narrow it down even further, we can say, well, we can go to John 3:16. But there are guiding principles. The guiding principle of Scientology is basically, you can be God. But you know something? That's the guiding principle of every cult. It doesn't matter. If it's Mormonism, as George talked about last week, that's the guiding principle. You can be God. Jehovah's Witness, you can be God. The Eastern religions, you can become part of God. So today, I want us to just consider the character of Scientology, exactly what is it, and where did it come from, who is the author and founder of the faith, because I think it's important that we understand a little bit about the author and founder of the faith of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard. Now, part of the confusion you encounter when you run into a Scientologist, when you talk about Scientology, is that ever since the death of L. Ron Hubbard, who was the founder of Scientology, back in January of 1986, the leaders of the church have attempted to distance themselves from the designation as a religion. By the way, this was in January of 1986. How many of us were alive in January of 1986? How many of us were adults in 1980? That's not that far away, is it? You know, we think about some of these ancient religions and these things that happened, you know, Islam that was just thousands of years ago, centuries ago. Even Mormonism, we're talking about 150 years. Well, you know, we talk about something like Scientology, we're talking about something that happened on our watch, something that grew and developed while we were growing. But ever since the death of L. Ron Hubbard back in January of 1986, the church, the movement of Scientology, has attempted to redefine itself. They will insist today, publicly, that they are not a church or a religion. Now the problem for them is, when you're a religion, there are certain expectations that naturally attach. Whether you are a false religion or a true religion, there are certain expectations that attach to something by virtue of its being a religion. First of all, there is an expectation that there is an ultimate power, an ultimate higher power. There is some being that is superior to you, that is existent. There is the expectation that there is an accountability, a level of accountability to that higher power. That as you go through life, as you say, I ascribe to these teachings, then you are accountable to whatever that higher power is. And there's an expectation that there's a moral lifestyle that falls in line with the teachings. You see, if you're a religion, regardless of the religion, you are saddled with those expectations. Now, Scientology teaches none of those. Scientology says there is no higher power. There is something that you can attain. There is this spirit power that you can become, but there is no God. Scientologists are atheists. There is no God. And therefore, since there is no God, is there any accountability? Absolutely not. Who are you accountable to? You're accountable to yourself. Absolutely. That's all. You're accountable to yourself. And there is no moral lifestyle as defined outside yourself. Who defines morality? If there is no higher power, if there is no accountability, then who defines the morality for the individual? Yourself. It's the individual. So Scientology says, see, we can't be a religion because we don't teach any of those things. The problem is they are a religion. They're just a very bad one. They're a very bad religion. Instead, once Hubbard died, the leaders of Scientology began to say, you know, we're not a religion, we're a science. I mean, the word Scientology, it's, you know, it, look at that, it's S-C-I-E-N, tology. You know, if you just had C-E, you would have science. And they said, see, we're a science, but we're dealing with religion. We're not dealing with Boggle. Okay, if this was Boggle, yeah, maybe two letters don't make them. Come on, nobody plays Boggle. Right. Nobody's ever played. That was a very specific joke. Yeah. There are so many reasons. I'm not a scientist. I have never pretended to be a scientist. But there are so many reasons why Scientology is not a science. I'll just throw out one. Scientology lacks any body of empirical data. Every legitimate area of science has a body of empirical data that they present. They say, look, here's our case studies. Here are our experiments. Here's our physical evidence that supports our science. That's what empirical data is. Even bad science has these things. Evolution, a terrible science. But you know why evolution can be torn apart? Because they have a body of empirical evidence that they present. They say, here is the hard evidence upon which we base our belief, our teaching. Now, that's how creationists can take it and tear it apart and say, that's ridiculous. You've misconstrued it. You've misrepresented it. You're blind. But they at least have a body of empirical evidence. Every legitimate science has a body of physical empirical evidence that they can present, that you can examine, that you can test, that you can prove or disprove. Scientology has no empirical evidence. Scientology is based on pure speculation. Now, they claim to be responsible for many physical and emotional healings, but they haven't presented anything to support those claims. They're like Benny Hinn without the Bible. You know, that's really what Scientology is, Benny Hinn without the Bible. Now, one time in the history of Scientology, as we'll see in a minute as we look at the history, Scientology really gets kicked off in 1950. It gets formalized in 1954, so a relatively new body of doctrine. One time, about 1956, L. Ron Hubbard tried to present empirical evidence of the legitimacy of Scientology. Hubbard trotted out a young college co-ed. This was about 1956. She was in her mid-20s. And Hubbard called a press conference of reporters out in Los Angeles. Kind of a mixed bag, I'm sure. It's Los Angeles. Even then, I think Los Angeles was probably crazy. But he calls together this press conference, and he takes this young lady, and he tells the reporters, he explains, that this young lady has proceeded through the seven steps of enlightenment in about a year, and that she has attained the highest level in the Church of Scientology, that she has attained what's called, we'll look at it less, she's an operating thetan. She's gone through the seven steps. Now, that tells me a couple things. First of all, it tells me that in 1956, Hubbard hadn't realized the money was in a slow process through the seven steps of enlightenment. This girl had gone through in just a little over a year. She had buzzed through those seven steps. Today, to get through those seven steps is almost impossible. People like Tom Cruise and John Travolta have gone through the seven steps, or they're working on the seventh step, and they have invested tens of millions of dollars to get there because the money is in dragging it out. Hubbard hadn't realized that. Back in 56, Hubbard's still making money off the book, Dianetics. But he realized eventually that the real money was in making people pay as you go. But in 1956, he drags this poor young lady, and he explains that she has attained this highest level of enlightenment. And he offers her as a case study to these reporters. And he said, fire away, ask her questions. Within 15 minutes, she had so completely discredited herself, discredited Hubbard and discredited Scientology that Hubbard ran in, stopped the interview, took the young lady away, and Scientology has never offered anyone else, including those figures like Tom Cruise, who are banned from speaking of such things, who are under a gag order from speaking of such things, from ever being presented again as empirical evidence. You cannot be a legitimate science unless you have a body of empirical evidence, empirical data that backs you up. That's it. So they're not a science. Okay, they say they're not a religion, they're not a science. Their fallback position has been, we're a philosophy. Oh, that's gray, isn't it? A philosophy. How many of you ever had to take a philosophy course in high school or college? Yeah, I mean, the one thing I learned about a philosophy course is people just sit around talking, and they never come to any conclusions, and everybody's supposition is as valid as the next person's. So that seems to be a pretty safe area. If you're Scientology, it's a pretty safe area because you're just kind of clouded in the mists of supposition. The problem is philosophy doesn't deal with issues like creation. I don't care what philosophy you get into, you never have to deal with things like creation. I don't care what philosophy you study, you never deal with things like the afterlife or eternity. Philosophy doesn't have a strict dogma that everyone is required to memorize and obey. And Scientology does all these things. Scientology talks about creation. It talks about the afterlife. It talks about eternity. It has a dogma. It has all of these things. So it's not a philosophy. It's a religion. And when if you're ever dealing with somebody who is enmeshed in Scientology, it's important to remember it's a religion, because as a religion, there are those moral expectations, the higher power, the accountability, the moral lifestyle. Here's just four good reasons why Scientology, or proofs that Scientology is a church, it's a religion. And it's ones that Scientologists can't refute. And so they kind of back off what they do. First of all, since 1954, Scientology has filed every year its income taxes with the state of Texas and the United States government as a religious organization. Nearly 60 years, 61 years of filing as a nonprofit religious organization, claiming their properties they hold as the properties of a religious nonprofit organization. And so they pay taxes on that basis. Do you really think Scientology wants the Internal Revenue Service to believe that, you know, we've been committing federal tax fraud for 61 years, you really need to nail us? No, they're a religion. Second, Scientology is one of the most litigious organizations around. If you deal with Scientology, you're probably going to get sued. If you do business with them, eventually they're going to sue you. If you join and quit, they're going to sue you. If you want to write an article about them, they're going to sue you. If you want to do a documentary on them, they're going to sue you. Scientology sues at the drop of a hat. They have in-house counsel who are Scientologists, and they sue. That's what they're there for. They never defend themselves against lawsuits because nobody bothers to sue the Church of Scientology. But the Church of Scientology sues left and right, and overwhelmingly, every lawsuit they bring is based in whole or in part on the Freedom of Religion Clause of the Bill of Rights. They go into court repeatedly, and have gone into court hundreds, even thousands of times over the last 60 years, suing under the Freedom of Religious Clause. The Hubbard's writings, Dianetics, and his related writings refer to it as the Church of Scientology. This is their own dogma. Oh, and in 1954, they incorporated in the state of California as the Church of Scientology. And you know something? 61 years later, they've never gone back and amended the incorporation, because they want to be, for tax purposes, for legal purposes, they want all the benefits of being a religion. But now that that's become a little dicey, they'd rather people thought of them as something else. You know, as Dan Rather, that news commentator, once said, you know, if it walks like a duck, and it talks like a duck, and has feathers like a duck, it's a Scientologist. No, he didn't say that because he would have been sued. He said, it's a duck. Well, Scientology walks like a religion, it talks like a religion, it acts like a religion, because it is a religion. And therefore, even though it's a false religion, it's a cult, all those expectations apply to it. Those same yardsticks apply to it. So where did it come from? Well, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with L. Ron Hubbard. And the Word was Dianetics. Where did it come from? Scientology came from the fertile mind of L. Ron Hubbard. Hubbard was born in 1911. He's been around for a while. He had no apparent religious upbringing, but he did show early promise as a writer. Hubbard could write. He had a great imagination. And by the mid-1930s, Hubbard was a successful, by those standards in those days, a successful science fiction writer. Now, keep in mind, looking back historically, what's going on in our country in the mid-1930s? Yeah, the Depression. Not just the Depression, it was the Great Depression. I used to love to listen to my parents talk about life during the Great Depression. They were out in Pennsylvania. Their families were outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And I loved to listen to the stories. My grandfathers both worked for the railroad. So my families were lucky because they had a job. Now, they worked 7 days a week, they worked 12 hours a day, and still couldn't quite make ends meet. They had to do other jobs, but at least they had work. Remember, my dad, as a 10, 11-year-old boy, after school every day would get a gunny sack and walk the railroad tracks, picking up lumps of coal that would fall off the train cars. And then he would take that bag, when it was full, door to door, through the neighborhood, and sell coal for a few cents a lump. Because people couldn't afford a full load of coal, they would buy a couple lumps of coal to heat their stoves or whatever for that day. And that's what Dad would do as a 10 or 11-year-old boy. That was amazing. But it was a terrible time for our country. Unemployment of anywhere from 25 to 60%, depending on the statistics you look at. Widespread unrest. You know, and really very little hope. And in that time frame, science fiction gained a real foothold. It had been around for a while, but science fiction became more and more popular. Why does that kind of writing become more and more popular in those times? What are people looking for? Yeah, escape. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for a diversion. They're looking for an escape. And science fiction offered that escape. And again, it offered that escape as fictional literature. It didn't offer that escape as hope for tomorrow. It offered that escape as fictional literature. And Hubbard and his colleagues were riding that kind of wave in the 1930s. Now, today, if you're a successful published writer, if you're a Stephen King, or if you're that woman who wrote the Harry Potter books, who wrote the Harry Potter books? Rowling's, yeah. Golly, I've got to write a book like that. I got to come up with an idea like Harry Potter. But if you're a published author, that comes with a certain financial reward, doesn't it? I mean, you're making some serious money. Back in the 1930s, that wasn't true of science fiction. While science fiction was gaining in popularity, it was still viewed as kind of the unwanted stepchild of literature. It was not rewarded. If you were a science fiction author, you were paid by the word. You were paid a penny a word. Now, if you're being paid a penny a word and you sit down to write something, what's that going to encourage? Lots of words. Yeah, lots of words. Big difference between 10 words for a dime and 100 words for a dollar. And so science fiction tended to be kind of wordy. The articles tended to be kind of wordy. In 1949, we're jumping ahead 14 years. 1949... Hubbard is in his late 30s, and he is a keynote speaker at a convention of science fiction writers that's being held in New Jersey, probably an appropriate place for science fiction writers, New Jersey, if you've ever visited. And Hubbard is recorded, both in the notes that people are taking and in actual recording, with this statement. He said, "Writing for a penny a word is ridiculous. If a man really wanted to make $1 million, the best way would be to start his own religion." That was Hubbard's statement in 1949. In 1950, Hubbard published Dianetics, the foundational work of Scientology, and he was off to the races. Dianetics. Have any of you ever read Dianetics? There you go, we got one Dianetics. It's an amazing book. It is the gospel of Scientology. Now, I would say that it is just like the Bible to Christians, but it's not, because Hubbard wrote other things later that are given equal importance or equal weight. But it is the foundational work. If you join Scientology, you are required to read Dianetics. You're not only required to read Dianetics, you're tested on what you've read so that you can show that you have at least a fundamental understanding. Maybe that's one thing we can take from Dianetics. You know, mandatory Bible study for all new Christians. But it's required. The book was a runaway bestseller. That shocked everybody, especially Hubbard. In the first year, it sold over 2 million copies. Hubbard was amazed. Now remember, now we're in 1950. What's happening to this country? We're out of the Great Depression. Where are we in 1950? What's going on? It's post-war. We're coming out of World War II. What's our economy like? Now, it's not good in 1950. You know, our economy is not good in 1950. We're shaky. We've come off a war economy, and the only time our country's had a good economy has been a war economy. It's kind of a transition time. What are we moving into in 1950? Well, no, not the hippies. We're way too... 1950, we didn't even know what hippies were. In 1950s, where are we? We're going to Korea. It's the Cold War. We're going into Korea. The economy is shaky. People are coming back from World War II. It's a very transient population. People are moving around a lot. For the first time, people are moving around a lot. And people are looking for answers. People are looking for alternatives to what's viewed as traditional teachings. People are unsettled. Dianetics is introduced into that mindset, and Dianetics is a runaway bestseller. Like I say, Hubbard was shocked. Hubbard was shocked. When he wrote Dianetics, he took it to his publisher. And again, he had been a published author for about 15 years by this time. He took Dianetics to his publisher. His publisher read through it and said, "This is trash. I'm not going to publish this." And they sent him packing. And this was a guy who was a successful, by those standards, published writer. But the editors looked at it at his publishing house, and they said, "No, this is garbage." So he started making the rounds. And there are tiers of publication houses. And he went to the first tier, and he was rejected. They all said, this is ridiculous. So he dropped down to the second tier. And they said, this is trash. Nobody wants this. This doesn't even make sense for science fiction. I mean, I know it's fiction, but this doesn't even make sense. And Hubbard continued to make the rounds for about a year, until he finally found a small publishing house in Los Angeles who agreed to publish it on two conditions. One, that Hubbard paid for half the publication. That was unheard of back then. Absolutely unheard of. Self-publishing, you know, there's so many things today. You write something, you can get it published if you'll spend the money. Back then, that just didn't exist. And second, Hubbard had to agree that the next couple science fiction books he wrote would be published by this publishing house. They were looking to get their foot in the door. They figured, okay, we'll take the loss with this Dianetics thing, but only if we're going to make a profit on the next two. Here's why that's important. Because no one thought it was going to be successful, Hubbard retained the publication rights to Dianetics. That was unheard of. Back then, and even to a large extent today, if somebody publishes your work, the publishing house got your rights. That meant they got most of the profits. 95% of the profits went to the publication house. The publisher here said, "Nah, you can keep it. Publication rights, you can keep it." So when the book was published, instead of making a few cents, a nickel, a dime per copy, Hubbard made $1 to $2 per copy, and it sold over 2 million books the first year. He made $2 to $4 million in the first year, and his fortune was made. Now, $2 to $4 million in 1950 dollars, what do you think that is today, in today's dollars? It's not $1 billion, but it's like $30 or $40 million in today's money. That's real money. You could do some damage with $30 or $40 million. Yeah, don't bother me with $2 million. Yeah, you can bother me with $2 million any day. $30 to $40 million. And he was on his way. That was 1950, 1951. Over the next 3 or 4 years, people began to seek Hubbard out. all of a sudden he began to get calls. He began to get mail from people who had read Dianetics, and their lives were changed. People began to seek him out at his home in Los Angeles. And in 1954, Hubbard's no fool, he incorporates the Church of Scientology, and he's on his way. He had become, in just 4 years, the author and finisher of the faith for Scientology. You know, you look at Hebrews 12:2, and that writer calls who the author and finisher of our faith? Yeah, Jesus Christ. Hubbard had become the Jesus Christ for Scientology. It was amazing. Now, if you're going to found a religion, you better have a good education, or maybe traveled a lot, or have a religious background. Hubbard managed to go through all his entire life without collecting any of those things. Hubbard had no religious background. He had no religious training. Unashamedly so. He claimed to have 2 doctoral degrees from Sequoia University, from the prestigious Sequoia University in California. Sequoia University was closed down in 1957 by the California Board of Education when it was discovered that Sequoia University was a 2-bedroom tract home in Los Angeles, one man, one printing press. For $50, you could get your bachelor's, $75, your master's, and $100, a PhD. Hubbard had gone all the way. 2 PhDs, spent $200. In some ways, this guy was just a visionary of Sequoia University. Now we have Sequoia Universities all over the place. Just go on the Internet. You can do the same thing today. Costs a little bit more money, but you know something? You can still get your degree for writing a check. This guy did it with Sequoia University. He claimed to have traveled extensively, but under investigation, it turned out his only travel had been a 2-year stint in the Navy after he got out of high school. So this man, apart from a high school education and a few shore leaves, had no qualifications other than a vivid imagination and the ability to tap into a void in humanity. That's really where cults hit, and that's what Scientology did. It was, Satan is opportunistic. Satan will use whatever works at that time. He's very flexible. You know, Christianity, it's even. It's across the board. It doesn't change. Satan just looks and says, okay, Where is this society at this time? What would hit? What might work? And he uses that. Well, that's how he used Scientology. Hubbard was married 3 times. His first wife divorced him for adultery. His second wife divorced him, claiming that he had kidnapped her, beaten her, tried to kill her, and committed adultery. So ladies, no matter who you married, you could have done worse. He should have known better than to marry the second woman. He met her while they were both members of a satanic cult in California in the 40s. It was led by a gentleman who had the name of Beast 666. You know, you wonder, what were his parents thinking when that child was born? What made them look at that little baby and said, we'll call him Beast 666? Probably not his birth name. Now, and that's probably not a good place to pick up a potential spouse. You know, I'm in a satanic cult. It's led by B666. Hey, you want to have coffee afterwards? No. Now, as it true to form, later in life, after Hubbard got Scientology rolling, he denied that he ever been a member of a satanic cult. He denied that he even knew someone named B666. But then members of this cult, former members, the cult had dissolved, this was in the 60s, came forward with articles that they claimed Hubbard had written. Hubbard said they're lying. They're liars. It doesn't matter what they say. I never heard of this cult. Then they started coming forward with articles that he had written in his original hand and had signed. And his signature was authenticated. And then Hubbard remembered, oh yeah, that. What I did was, Naval Intelligence asked me to infiltrate this cult for purposes of national security. So yes, for a time I did go into it. I was there on behalf of the Naval Intelligence, and that's what it was. Of course, when Naval Intelligence was contacted, what do you think they said? What? We never heard of this guy or this cult. I mean, yeah, records show that when he got out of high school, back there in the the mid 20s, the late 20s, he was an ensign for just an enlisted man for 2 years. That was it. Of course, then Hubbard said, "See, national security, they can't comment. It's a no lose situation." Hubbard died on January 24th, 1986. At that time, he was still married. He married a third woman. That apparently took. They were married till he died, Mary Sue Whipple. He stayed true to her even after she was sent to federal prison in 1977 for acts of espionage against our government. But true love. When he died, the officials of the Church of Scientology said he didn't die. He just discarded this life form to move on to the next level of research. I never really heard hell referred to as a level of research, but I suppose it is. If that's true, he will be researching for eternity. Hebrews 9:27 says it's appointed unto each of us once to die. Hubbard had an appointment. He met it in January of 1986. Now, you might think, I thought this was a class on Scientology. I thought we were going to look at Scientology. And we are, but I think it is imperative when we look at any religion, when we look at any body of religious teaching, I think it's important that we consider the character of the individual who started it, the character of the one who's behind it. I mean, don't we rely on the character of God as Christians? The world can attack the Bible. They can attack our statement of faith. They can attack our mode of worship, but can't we always fall back on the character of God? The character of God is revealed through His Word. The character of God is revealed through Jesus Christ. The character of God is revealed through creation. I mean, what are some of the things that God has revealed to us about His character that we can rely on no matter what the world says, no matter what charges are brought? We can say, look, here's the character of the God who established this religion. What are some of those characteristics of God? The attributes of God? What? Forgiveness and love. He is a God of forgiveness. He is a God of love. And we can count on that. What else do we know about God? He's unchanging, immutable. This is a God that doesn't change. As we'll see, one of the tenets of Scientology is that their power is a constantly evolving power. We look at a God who doesn't change. When we read Genesis 1:1, we read about the God who is identical to the God that we read about in the book of Revelation. And there is no variance in that God between Genesis 1:1 and the end of Revelation. He's unchanging. What else do we know about God? He's what? He cannot lie. What else? He's just. He's all the omnis. Yeah, it has nothing to do with that wonderful theater in Fort Worth where I get dizzy every time I go over and see a movie. Yeah. But he's all those omnis, omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. But we can depend. He is sinless. And we can look, and we know those are the attributes of God, many more. And how does God flesh those out? Through Jesus Christ. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In Jesus Christ, we see the personification of those attributes. We see those beautiful characteristics of God played out on this earth in human form. And we can look at those and we can say, Jesus Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, is all these things. And because the author and finisher of our faith is all these things, we have the right, in fact, we have the obligation to accept them, to believe them. That's the author and finisher of our faith. We look at Scientology. We look at the character of the author and finisher of their faith. L. Ron Hubbard, someone with a high school education, someone who was proven during his life to to time and time again perjure himself under oath, a man who misrepresented both his experience, his training, his education, an adulterer, a satanic worshiper. This is the author and finisher of Scientology. Let me tell you something. It is imperative when we look at a cult that we go back far enough that we say, okay, where did it start, who founded it, and what is their character? Because the cult, George Patton, General George Patton, had that famous line, one of the many famous lines. He said, no army will exceed the character of its leader. Well, you know something? No religion will exceed the character of its leader. No religion will exceed the character of its founder. We will not exceed the character of God. Scientology will never exceed the character of L. Ron Hubbard. It's ingrained. It's ingrained. That's why we look at the character. That's what Scientology is. That's their background. It's a church. It's a false church. It's a religion. It's a cult. But all those expectations of church and religion attached to it. It's founded by a man who is a reprobate at best, who was trying to line his own pockets, and who succeeded in doing so. He was a con man. He was a science fiction artist who found his pot of gold at the end of a rainbow called Dianetics. Now, next week we're going to look in much more detail at the theology. But in the time we have left, I just want to take a few minutes to consider the foundational truth of Scientology. What's it based on? Where did Hubbard get all this stuff? The base. Now remember, when we go through this, I always like to think, when I'm studying a thing about Scientology, I always think of Star Trek. Because the language of Scientology, the language of Dianetics, is science fiction. It's right out of Star Trek. The characters of Scientology are right out of science fiction. And when I study Scientology, I always think of it from a science fiction standpoint. So I always think Star Trek. The basis for Scientology lies in the revelation of the Thetan. The Thetan. A Thetan, well actually, Hubbard didn't discover a Thetan. A Thetan discovered Hubbard. Thetans are, according to Scientology, ancient spirits that exist intergalactically. Thetans on this earth have been around for 85 billion years. 85 billion years. That's a long time. I had a second grade teacher, Mrs. Gray, who I suspected of being about 85 billion years old. I can never nail that down, but man, she was the oldest looking person I have ever encountered in my life. I'm undoubtedly older today than she was when she taught me. She probably aged a few billion in that year that I had her. So I can grasp the concept of 85 billion years. You notice anything familiar about this word thetan? The word theta is the Greek word for God. Add an N, get a God. That's all Scientologists did. Now, a Thetan at its highest level, a Thetan is called an operating Thetan. If you reach that level, you remain invisible unless you choose to manifest yourself to someone. The Thetan that revealed himself to Hubbard was an operating Thetan. This Thetan possessed the ability to move independently and to reveal himself in a physical form. Thetans are timeless, according to Hubbard, except they came into existence 95 trillion years ago. They've only been on Earth for 85 billion years, but Hubbard explained that they've been around for 95 trillion years. Now, 95 trillion years is a lot of years, but it's still a time, isn't it? It's not an eternity. There was a time, even in Hubbard's teachings, when Thetans did not exist. You notice how in science fiction always deals in billions and trillions of years. If you've read science fiction, you notice that the use of billions and trillions are thrown around. Why? Well, because it looks like what? It's huge. It's a huge number. It's one that nobody can really argue with. And it is, after all, just science fiction. So it's okay when it's fiction. It doesn't matter if you talk in billions or trillions or quadrillions, because time becomes unimportant in science fiction. Well, Hubbard just reaches in and says, here it is, 85 billion, but they're 95 billion. They're capable, in their highest form, of intergalactic travel, which beats mass transit. It's intergalactic travel. They are capable of being introduced into various interplanetary life forms. I love that phrase, interplanetary life forms. Interplanetary. Because if you've done any reading of science fiction, you know interplanetary life forms is a common phrase in science fiction. Because that covers everything. We are an interplanetary life form in science fiction. Mankind, we're simply the interplanetary life form of the planet Earth. But you go to other planets, and there's other interplanetary life forms. What was that series with Tommy Lee Jones? Yeah, Men in Black. That was a great science fiction. Those are three great science fiction movies. You know, Men in Black, because they're kind of comedies, and they have all those interplanetary life forms that are at the transport stations, and they all look so funny, and they're all goofy. But that's science fiction. Hubbard was serious. And even at their top level of operating thetans, they are constantly evolving. Once a thetan reaches that operating level, they're always getting better and better and better. Always. Thetans came to this great planet Earth as part of an intergalactic... Yes? Because operating thetan, Hubbard would say, or would have said, operating thetan is like making the honor roll in school. There's no super honor roll. So you're here. Now, within that, you can always do better. You can always learn more. Okay? So that's how they're constantly evolving, is that they become better at what they're doing. They're capable of intergalactic travel, but as they evolve, they're better at it. They go faster. Okay? They control their own environment, but they control it better as they evolve. They came to this Earth about 85 billion years ago. And they inhabit, and this is important, this is really, if you take nothing else away from this class this morning, they inhabit each one of us. You, according to Scientology, are inhabited by at least one and possibly many thetans. Well, it's aliens, but they're thetans. They're not aliens, they're spirit beings. That's not indigestion. The way you can tell, according to Hubbard and Scientology, that a thetan is at work in you is when you exercise what they call the analytic mind. When you reason. When you learn. When you come to an understanding on anything. That is actually the thetan within you that is promoting that. The purpose of every thetan is to develop the individual into an operating thetan. Every thetan within an individual wants that person that they inhabit to evolve during their lifetime into an operating thetan. If you evolve into an operating thetan at the moment of death, what we refer to as your soul is absorbed into this thetan, and then you're off to intergalactic travel. Now, there are many problems with that. First of all, and first and foremost, the only way you can evolve into an operating thetan is by adherence to what? Scientology, yeah. You got to be in Scientology to evolve. You can't evolve any other way. And Scientologists are a very small percentage of people. But that's the only way you get there. If you do not make that quantum leap to operating thetan, which is like glorification only without the trappings of religion or God or glorification or righteousness or holiness or any of that stuff. If you do not make that level, when the body dies, the host body dies, the thetan returns to an implant station. This is a religion. This is what Tom Cruise believes. This is what John Travolta believes. This is what Priscilla Presley believes. And there are several million people who believe this. But in return, where do you think our nearest implant station is?
Detroit.
It's not Detroit. No. See, if there was an implant station in Detroit, that might be able to be found and recognized. No? No? Venus. Venus. You see, in science fiction, if you want to put something, if you want to place something, you always place it beyond reach. That is so important in science fiction, is you place it beyond reach because that allows the imagination to go where the body will not. And so Hubbard simply placed the implant station on Venus because nobody can get to Venus. And there, at that implant station, the thetan, the spirit being, is given a memory erasing chip, which basically wipes out everything they learned during their period of time on Earth, and they wait to be reimplanted on a baby, or inside a baby, right before birth. And then the process begins all over again. That is the basic teaching of Scientology. This continues until that thetan manages to transform that person into that highest level. At that point, they'll travel the galaxies at will, which is what I think the Navy promises, but it never comes true. You answer to no one, and you control your own environment and those around you. That's the highest level. You know, one of the attributes of God is the ability, God is independent. You know, one of the most amazing attributes, I think, of God is that God is the only independent one in existence. God operates, God exists independently of anyone or anything. That's one of the amazing things about God. Scientology promises that at the highest level, you will act independently of anyone and anything. You will control everything and everyone around you. You will go where you want to go. You'll do what you want to do. You'll answer to no one. In effect, Scientology promises that you will be what? You'll be God. That sound familiar? You know, back in Isaiah chapter 14, Isaiah is describing Satan in his pre-fall days. You remember, Satan says that I'll sit on the hill. I will reign. I will be like the Most High. That's all Satan asked for. Satan didn't want God to go away. Satan just wanted to join God as God. Well, Scientology says you can be your own God. This is the draw. This is the draw. You will be like the Most High God. Now, that's only if you become the operating thetan. How do you become an operating thetan? How do you climb to the top of the pyramid? How do you travel intergalactically? How can you control your environment? Especially if you have young children, this might be attractive. That's what we'll look into next week. How do you climb the steps in Scientology? How do you attain the unattainable? If you were going to form a religion, if you had to form a religion, where would you start? Would you start with creation? Would you start with a body of doctrine? Or would you start on a distant planet, far, far away, space, the last frontier? The tragedy is, even a religion that is so fundamentally flawed, so grounded in fiction, has found a home among millions of people, not only in America, but around the world. There are people who are hitching their eternities to this body of teaching. You know, back in Matthew 7, 24 through 27, Jesus delivered that very familiar story about the two builders, the one who built the house on the sands, the one who built the house on the rock. You know, everyone who builds his house on a cult's religion, on Scientology and its teachings, is building that house on the sands. And what was the end of that house? Great was what? Yeah, great was the destruction thereof. The tragedy is there are many people who are taking out building permits on the sands of Scientology every day. The good news is that we have the gospel. And when we encounter someone who finds themselves enmeshed in Scientology or any other cult, what we are called upon to do is present the gospel. If we encounter a Scientologist, it's important that they see that what they're involved in is not a science, it is not a philosophy, it is a religion. And as a religion, it has certain expectations. Those expectations include the existence of a higher power. They need to see what that higher power is. It's not a thetan that came around 85 billion years ago. It's a God. That there is accountability to him. That there is a moral expectation of a lifestyle. We present that. You know, this week, as you encounter individuals, whether they're in Scientology or something else, remember, that is our charge. It's the gospel. It's the gospel. It doesn't change. And it's based on that wonderful character of God, that unchanging character of God that we can always turn to and rely on. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, we thank you that you do have your word, that you revealed yourself through your word, that you revealed the truth through your word, that you revealed the gospel through your word. This week, Lord, may we look for opportunities to share that truth. Lord, it's not enough that we can stand back and say, oh, these people are so wrong, how silly of them. Lord, these people are wrong, but they're going to hell based on that error. Lord, may we see that. May you give us hearts of compassion. And Lord, may we not be caught up in the minutia of debate. May we simply present your gospel in an understandable way. Lord, and may we trust you to work in the hearts and minds of those to whom we speak. And we pray this in your name. Amen.